we launch new companies within Hims & Hers essentially every 90 days. We launch new conditions, sleep, HIV prevention, diabetes, weight loss, anxiety, depression, primary care. Each of these are standalone companies that can be doing $1 billion in revenue. And what I thought was really fascinating, well, if Livongo is one of them doing just, let's say, diabetes, and that's a really big company, I think you could build a brand here underneath which has 10 or 15 of them. And now that's a really big company.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Andrew Dudum is the co-founder and CEO of modern healthcare brand Hims & Hers. Hims & Hers is valued at over $2 billion, and it's revolutionizing the telehealth experience. The platform allows an easy and private way to take control of one's own healthcare experience virtually, encouraging customers to no longer feel self-conscious about that visit to the doctor or to purchase drugs. Previous to Hims & Hers, Andrew co-founded Atomic, a venture builder in San Francisco backed by Peter Thiel and Mark Andreessen, and is an active angel investor and advisor to over 24 startups. He also co-founded Ever.com in 2013, one of the top iOS productivity apps that goes across 95 plus countries. Additionally, he founded LendForPeace.com, the first non-for-profit micro-lending platform for the Middle East. With an incredible success story like Andrew's, I began by asking about his own roots. I was so curious about what it was like for him to grow up in San Francisco.
I grew up a little closer to the beach than towards Sand Hill. So back then, you know, San Francisco is kind of a small village. It's you know, 7 by 7 miles. You know everyone, same high schools, same middle schools. Everyone kind of grew up together. It's still that way today, just obviously much more involved with the industry we're in. But super, you know, super blessed to be able to grow up in a beautiful place like this that also has so many career opportunities, right? For the industry that I love and have spent the last 15 years building companies in. It's nice to be able to do that surrounded by family and friends.
Totally. I love San Francisco. It's such a beautiful city and just such a great place. And it, you know, but whenever I interview anyone who's like, you know, gone through raising money, Silicon Valley, they're never from San Francisco.
Yeah.
you're the first guy. So that's pretty
right.
Cool.
That's definitely true. None of the VCs are from here. None of the entrepreneurs. So yeah, I'm one of the rare unicorns, I guess, from a local guy standpoint.
I like it. So tell me about, I want to know what the feeling's like, because you guys, you just went public recently, I guess, within the past year.
Yep,
and what's that like to get up there and just, did you ring the bell? Was that the opening?
We did. We rang the bell, the New York Stock Exchange. We did a lot of the stuff digital just because of the pandemic. We zoomed in different parties, but it's wild. I mean, the whole thing is crazy, to be honest. And I think with our story in particular, we went public just a month after our third birthday as a company, right? So I think it was either the fastest or one of the fastest companies from kind of launch to going public. And I think the most memorable part of it for me is when a company grows that quickly, the people that you started the company with are also still there.
Yeah,
they're all around the table. You know, and that was just really special to me is, you know, we were ringing this bell and I looked around and saw who else was there. And, you know, it's half the people were the people that were there 6 months before we launched, who were just grinding and fixing things that were breaking in real time. And to be able to share that with them when the memory of launching was so recent and so top of mind, it was just, I think, really special for me. That was big.
Yeah, that's totally great insight, because most companies, it's years later and those people that were busting their ass and breaking their back, and like you said, fixing like computers, are still with you and they're there. That's got to be so fulfilling for you as a founder.
Totally. Because I think, you know, I advise a lot of buddies and friends that start and run companies. And one of the things I tell them is from an excitement standpoint and like a milestone standpoint, you're always stretching for the next one. So like, you know, you raise your seed round and it's like, you want to celebrate it and you're so excited. But the second you get that money in the bank, you're thinking about your A and how you're going to raise your Series A. And then you hit 100K in revenue. And all you're thinking about is, man, it's going to be so amazing when we hit 1 million in revenue. The problem is when you hit 10 million in revenue, all you're thinking about is 100 million. And then when you hit 100 million in revenue, all you're thinking about is 500 million. And so, you know, I think celebrating milestones is really hard when building a company because type A people are trying to get to the next milestone. But, you know, I think taking the company public was different in that we really, I think, forced ourselves to like sit back and appreciate what this team had built and be really thankful for the team. And I think that was really special because the, you know, the success of it, like, oh, it's a public company now, you know, it's just as exciting as when we made our first $1 million, to be honest. It just, the excitement doesn't get more exciting or less exciting, but I think the meaningfulness was different.
Yeah, it's really an incredible story. And when you talk about the short period of time, it's absolutely baffling. So I do want to go back to the start of the business. How did you come up with the idea, the concept for Hims and Hers?
You know, it was this combination of human instinct and business mind. And I think all great companies have this nice balance between some art and some science dynamics in there. And I've been an entrepreneur for the last 15 years. I've been building companies for a long time. So I'm always looking for unique opportunities that have great underlying fundamentals, that have really transformational platform shifts happening in the market that would allow for something really unique to be created. And also something that just resonates with me as a human, right? And so I think Hims and Hers has all of those things. You've got a healthcare industry that all of us hate using, just from at a human level. Men will avoid the doctors unless they're bleeding from the head.
It's, right? So
it's just like, it's so true. And that means that we are not getting the care we need. And we're not having the tough conversations about things that are bugging us. And a third of the men in this country are suffering from anxiety and depression, and they're not talking about it. And half of them are suffering from dermatology issues, and they don't bring it up to anybody, right? And these things should be, they're all very solvable, right? So they should be brought up. So this ability to create a brand that rips out all the complexities of the healthcare, like the stigma, the me talking about something awkward to a nurse or to a doctor in person, get rid of that. Get rid of the fact that it takes 2 hours to like wait in line and take time off of work and drive. Get rid of that. Get rid of all the complexity of cost, like what's insured, what's not insured. Make that just really simple, like $20, right? Just simplify it all down so I can pick up my phone from the comfort of my couch, just like I pick up my phone to order some food or buy a t-shirt or get an Uber to, you know, come, just that simple, and then connect to a specialist, get whatever I need treated, have it delivered to my door, seamless, beautiful, affordable. That just felt like it needed to exist. It's like, it's ridiculous to me that almost everything in the country is built in that type of digital first on-demand manner, except healthcare. So I think that was something that just got me really excited and really passionate. And then secondary, you just had these platform changes where all of a sudden things like telemedicine were illegal, right? Quite frankly, 5 years ago, this company was not possible. You could not build this company. And it's because from a regulatory standpoint, it didn't support it. But today you can text message with a doctor. You can send photos of your acne and you email them to your doctor, and your doctor can look at them and watch them and make a recommendation for a treatment. That pharmacy could then ship the meds to your door. All of this is new, and it's allowing us to frankly rebuild the whole health system in a way that is prioritizing the customer front and center.
How's the pandemic? I would imagine that really catapulted your business.
You know, it's really interesting. If you look at the financials of the business, it actually didn't.
Wow.
Which is unique. I think we're one of the few companies actually in telemedicine where the business has grown really steady every single quarter for the last 3 years. And there was nothing outlier in our economics where all of a sudden the pandemic hit and this new wave of people now were using us. And I think it's because we were, from the beginning, always going after kind of the young patient, the patient that was already digitally savvy and already really comfortable with telemedicine. And when you talk to those patients, them in their 20s and 30s, they're all using telemedicine already. Now, I think what the pandemic did was it accelerated the adoption curves of those in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Like when you survey those people, almost none of them had tried telemedicine a year plus ago. Now, almost 80%.
Yeah.
So it did this great silver lining with regard to accelerating the adoption of a technology that's going to make everyone's life better. It really will. And it's going to be here to stay, because once you experience talking to a doctor from your couch and you see the medicine arrive at your door the next day, you're not going to go back in, you know, for that issue. It's just not going to be the case. And I think when you talk to doctors that are in the industry, they tell you about 90% of the reason you go into a brick and mortar hospital, you can be treated for online in a telemedicine world. So it's really just accelerated, I think, a trend that was already really happening with the young demographic in a way that probably would have taken 5 or 10 years to occur, but it took place in a year because of the uniqueness of the environment.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm a Renaissance man. I'll admit I've got a lot of anxiety, stress, follically challenged. So I might never, I mean, there's still stigma. But how have you been able to alleviate the stigma? What are the reasons behind that?
You know, the stigma is really deep rooted, especially for men. For women, you know, there's other issues when dealing with healthcare. There's frictions and people getting in the way of them really being empowered to take control of their health. For men, the issue is much more around the fact that we don't feel comfortable taking care of ourselves. Right. And I was really blessed. I have two sisters, an older sister, a younger sister. I'm kind of sandwiched between them, who are trendy and cool and loud. So they
sounds like my daughters.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Like they had no problem telling me when I was 14 that I had to get my shit together and fix my acne. Right. And they have no problem today in my 30s telling me I look tired and I should go get some moisturizer. Right. Or that, you know, my hair looks messy. I need to go get a haircut, or I'm losing my hair. I need to go fix that. I mean, they're the first ones to tell me. And so a big part about the Hims and Hers brand is actually being that friend that is just raw and authentic and is like, hey, it's normal for you to lose your hair. The reality is 50% of men are losing their hair right now, 50%. So if half the country is losing their hair and there's medicines that are 95% effective with almost no side effects, what the hell are you doing not getting it treated? It's affordable, it's safe, and it's right there, right? Like, so I think the brand is really about normalizing this stuff and encouraging them to be well, and then making it really easy to connect with an expert, understand the options, make it affordable. And then lastly, make it something that you're excited to use. I mean, who, like, you come back from the pharmacy, you got that white bag with some like bottle of pills, and you feel terrible, you feel sick, right? With Hims and Hers, when you buy, let's say, a set of products for hair loss, they're going to show up to your door and they're going to be beautiful. They're going to smell amazing. They're going to taste amazing. The vitamins, they're going to be bottles you're going to want to leave up on your bedroom stand, because people are going to come in and be like, wow, what's that? And that's also very intentional, because that's how you get rid of the stigma. You get this stuff out of the medicine cabinet and you get it onto the kitchen counter, right? And then all of a sudden people are talking about it and much more comfortable using it.
Yeah, well, I'm signing up because this Rogaine has not worked for like 25 years.
There you go. We just launched a new one, I think yesterday, which is a new product that's a mix of minoxidil and finasteride compounded into a spray that you can just spray on your hair every morning. That's it.
I love it. I love it. So let's talk about starting this business. Like you said, healthcare industry. I mean, it's such a beast. Jumping into this business, first off, how did you do it? Tell me about those early days.
Yeah. You know, I think from the beginning, we realized the beast of healthcare, and somebody once referred it to me as a healthcare industrial complex. It's like this massive industry is so big that most founders have failed to ever build something interesting in it, right? Because you've got so many entrenched incentives and entrenched players that changing how people think and how money flows is not really possible. And so our approach was really different, which was, hey, we want to build something really unique. We want to build something beautiful and seamless and affordable. None of those words usually are words you hear when you think about the healthcare system. So the only way we're going to do that is we're going to build it from scratch, entirely from scratch. And so the early days were us grinding for probably a year or two before we ever launched this thing, building the actual infrastructure necessary to support where we are today. And what that means is it's things like provider groups. We need hundreds of doctors licensed in every single state in the country that are specialists in every single one of these conditions we treat. Massive operationally complex thing to build. You need a full telemedicine platform that's safe, HIPAA compliant, secure, with an EMR where doctors can be treating patients. Things like Epic, which are institutional software options, haven't been changed in 10, 20 years, not options. So we had to rebuild it, like rebuild the whole healthcare technology stack. We needed to rebuild the pharmacy. We have a 300,000 square foot pharmacy in Ohio, which is actually what distributes the medication to your door to afford at affordable prices quickly. You can't rely on Walgreens to give you a good price, or you know, who knows if the CVS is open, right? So we felt like we had to go and build it. And so, you know, the early days were a grind. It was a lot of technology. It was a lot of infrastructure work, but it was just necessary for the vision, which was a totally seamless experience. The only way we were going to get that is if we built it. And so now, a few years later, we're powering thousands of medical visits per day on the platform. If you look at it kind of on a relative basis, let's say a company like Teladoc. It's an amazing company. It's a $30, $40 billion company. It took Teladoc 13 years for them to power their first 1 million medical visits on the platform, which was really fast. We did 1 million medical visits in the first 12 months of operation. So the speed of growth has just been wild. And I think that the early days were really all about just fixing the infrastructure, improving it, and just making the thing work, like just make the engine work.
How'd you grow so fast?
I think there's two parts of that question. The first is my DNA and the company's DNA is customers. So we know our customer. We know how to talk to them. We know what they're struggling with. For each of these different conditions, we know where they live. We know where they shop. And we're consumers and marketers first and foremost. So we just have, I think, a DNA of monetizing, acquiring, and growing that is really unique to healthcare, right? We don't outsource that. That's the DNA of the business, how we show up, where we show up, the places we deploy money, how we track that. We are just this really fun blend of art and science in an org. And I think that's just because my 10 years prior was building companies in consumer, direct-to-consumer expertise. So I think that's a big part of it. And we had strategized for anyone, you know, that if you lived in New York, like you did, you probably saw us everywhere. You saw us in subway stations, podcast, radio. If you're, you know, going to the bathroom at Giant Stadium, you probably saw us in front of the urinal as you're.
I'm a Jet season ticket holder, unfortunately. So
there you go, the Jets. So like, you know, we were in the right places. And that I think was just something we are as an organization really good at. But then on the other side of it, this is just something people needed. They really did need it. There's 50 million men in the country losing their hair. About 100,000 of them are getting treated, right? There's 50 million men suffering from sexual wellness issues. About 600 to 800,000 are getting treated. There's probably 100 million men and women suffering from depression. 1% are getting treated, right? So the country is not well. The country is sick and stressed and struggling, and the healthcare system isn't doing its job. And so I think we had this amazing product market fit from the beginning, just from knowing the customer and hopefully being able to deliver something that really resonated with them.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Hey, business owner, did you know that over 4.2 billion people are active on social media now? That means if you want to connect with your customers or find new ones, you need social. If you want to build loyalty and stand out from the competition, you need social. And if you want to make using social media easier, more impactful, you need Hootsuite. Hootsuite is the must-have tool for managing and growing your business on social. Hootsuite makes it easy to find your audience, whether on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, or Pinterest. You can schedule content, publish posts, and track your success all in one place. Millions of businesses around the world are already using Hootsuite to supercharge their social efforts. And now it's your turn. Go to hootsuite.com/HSH to start your free trial and get 50% off your first year. That's hootsuite.com/HSH for a free 30-day trial and 50% off your first year.
And we're back.
Were you personally always into or fascinated by healthcare or health and wellness?
I wasn't interested in the healthcare space in general from a business standpoint. You know, I was always really excited personally about the wellness space, the health and wellness space as an individual. So I was always researching. I was always reading blogs. I was talking to people. I was chatting with doctors. Like, just as a personal interest standpoint, I always felt like, you know, I want to bring the best version of myself to the market, right? Every day when I wake up, how do I do that? And so I think part of this, and this is also a philosophy that I have, is some of the best companies, I never grew up with money. I never grew up exceptionally wealthy by any means, but I saw people with money. And I think a startup and business philosophy I've always had is, how do you build something where it takes what the 1% of people have in this world and makes it available to everybody? And you think of a company like Uber, that's exactly what it did. You had, you know, the ability to have a limousine back in the day. If you were wealthy, you had a limo. Well, now anybody can click their phone and have a black car show up. And it was exactly, and now it's, you know, a Honda Civic that shows up. It's not a black car, but it still gets the job done. And with healthcare, if you're really wealthy, you have somebody you can text at any point in your day who can help navigate the healthcare system for you and connect you to specialists, get you the medicines you need, get you the tests you need, have them delivered to your door. You just have that. And if you're just a normal person, you don't have any of that, right? You got to go through waiting 3 or 4 weeks for an appointment and then grind it out. And you have to be an advocate on behalf of yourself. And so to me, what was really cool is if I could take what that 1% has and turn it into a platform that everybody could get, you know, that could be really, really powerful. And I think there was a lot of excitement in helping the country in that regard in healthcare.
That's awesome. You guys grew so quickly, so fast. I asked this question to every entrepreneur and they come back to me with a laundry list from, I'm just curious, was there a time with the business? I mean, it's still so young where there was a challenge that you honestly were thinking this might not work.
Laundry list. There's probably, you know, it's been 4 years or so since we started this. You know, what I tell my team, my management team, is it feels like you need to rebuild and save the company every 12 months, which I think is the reality. You know, when you launch it, certain channels work for growth, certain monetizations work, certain products are exciting. And then you wake up one day and there's 3 other people selling that product. Or Google got really expensive. Well, you can't grow anymore, right? Or your supply chain, the pharmacy that was delivering all your products, they're raising their costs. And now your margins don't make sense. Or hey, the doctors we had just built the whole thing around, they're getting poached up by another healthcare system. So no one's on the platform. I mean, there, I think every 6 months, something that feels apocalyptic happens. And I think it probably takes a repeat entrepreneur, and I've been lucky enough to be doing it for a long time, to realize that that's just the normalcy. Like, that is the game. Yeah. The game is like, your every day is innovating. You can, there's no way you could rest on your laurels because it will just disappear over a year. So I think, you know, there have been times that where you think the whole thing is going to crash, where you learn insights and you think the whole thing is doomed. And I think for me, it's just been about, from a psychology standpoint, remembering that, oh, here's another one. Like, let's take the 20 minutes to panic, and then let's go spend the next 3 months fixing it. And then another one's going to happen again. And you just keep doing that over and over again.
And you've been able to do that psychologically, just to train yourself in that way? Because I just know, being an entrepreneur myself, there's always those challenges and fears, and people have different ways of getting over them. And the number one thing is, for every person we've had on this show and anyone I've known who's been successful, they've been able to pick themselves off the mat and keep going.
Yeah.
What is it in you that drives that?
You know, I think at the core, it's a confidence in my abilities to figure it out, to be honest. And I think that confidence probably grew in the last 15 years of building companies, where you see yourself get knocked down big time and then struggle your way back to stand, but get stronger. And when that's happened a lot, you build a little bit of muscle, cognitive muscle, to be able to say, oh, fuck, this is a big one. This is like, this one's going to knock me down. But I've got 15 data points in the last 5 years of things that were pretty gnarly like this, and I figured out a way. So I'm pretty sure I can figure out a way, right? And I think that confidence builds over time. I also think there's something that I've just grown to really believe, is that you make your own luck. Like, there is no luck in this game that doesn't come from you just grinding really fucking hard. But if you grind, you will be lucky, right? Like you truly do. You truly can create luck. And so, you know, I just really subscribe to that philosophy of like, if you work hard and you work smart and you're a good person and you grind it out, like the cards are going to turn your way. They just will. And you just kind of, you got to keep pushing that extra mile to see it happen, you know, sometimes, but I've seen it enough to believe that that's the truth.
Yeah, I totally love that. And I totally agree with you. It's a grind and it's interesting. And that's why I'd ask you the question about challenges. And I love the answer about the laundry list and about the grind, because a lot of people, they'll see you and they'll be like, oh, 3 years, this must have been easy street. And, you know, he's going public. And it's always such a great reminder, especially talking to folks as successful as yourself in the business world, that everything, every business is a grind.
Yeah, no, it's a grind. Even the most successful ones. And I would say we were really lucky again. And I think we created this luck in that we knew our customer well. So what we launched on day zero was what they wanted. But just because, you know, our product market fit was there on day zero, what happened on day one is that everything broke, right? Quite literally everything broke. We had to rebuild the whole thing. So it's a grind no matter what way you cut it. But it is rewarding when you start grinding on issues that come from scale, right? It is the hardest parts to me of building companies has always been those days when you're grinding and you're trying to unlock the spark. You're trying to figure out the thing that people love and you know it's there and you're kind of close to it, but you haven't quite nailed it. That's the toughest one, but it stays tough. It just changes.
Was there a day like that during the last few years that you were like, I think we hit on something?
Yeah, there have been days like that, you know, and I think the fun part about the Hims and Hers model, and this is quite frankly, one of the driving reasons of why I started this company, is it's intellectually really interesting to me. We launch new companies within Hims and Hers essentially every 90 days. We launch new conditions, sleep, HIV prevention, diabetes, weight loss, anxiety, depression, primary care. Each of these are standalone companies that can be doing $1 billion in revenue. And what I thought was really fascinating, well, it's like, well, hell, if Livongo is one of them doing just, let's say, diabetes, and that's a really big company, I think you could build a brand here underneath which has 10 or 15 of them. And now that's a really big company, right? So from intellectual standpoint, we have the ability to test and bring these things to market. And a lot of them fail, but it is exciting because to your point, you know, every year you kind of get a couple of those moments of like, ah, man, I think we found something new here. I think this product and this market and this demand, it's like, it's really going to work out. And we're seeing it start to happen early in the numbers. So to me, as a entrepreneur, the Hims and Hers umbrella and us as a public company is essentially a large pool of capital for healthcare innovation, right? Because I think over the next decade, the whole thing is going to change. And if we believe 90% of the reason you go into the hospital is going to be moved into a digital fashion, that means I've got a lot of room to grow and invest in, because probably less than 5% or anything is even taking place in telemedicine today from that world. So yeah, we're really lucky in that we get a lot of that pattern recognition and that excitement of trying to find something new.
Have you personally felt more pressure or anxiety, stress from running a public company as opposed to a private company?
You know, not really, to be honest. I think that's been one of the maybe surprising elements of the transition from a private company to a public company. And I think it's in part because I was trained over the last 5 years with really good institutional investors on my board, right? Like I am used to people scrutinizing everything I'm doing and questioning and asking about the vision and asking how I'm going to balance the growth versus the efficiency and why the trade-offs, when, how much of it's going to come from the new markets versus the old markets and when's it going to saturate? I mean, these are questions that, you know, I ran a fund for a long time. Those are questions I ask myself first, right? So I'm used to, I think, that dynamic where entering the public market hasn't been uniquely different. You've got shareholders, say you're trying to create as much wealth for as possible. You've got customers you're trying to improve the health of as much as possible. And you've got a team you're trying to keep as focused and healthy and positive as possible. It's really like those three dynamics. And I don't think they really change.
Yeah. Is there anything you learned recently in the last couple of years that you wish you knew early on in your career?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. You know, I think it took me a while as a CEO and as a founder to realize I had the ability to build the organization to complement what I loved doing and what I was no good at. And I think that's in the beginning years for me felt like a weakness. I felt like I needed to be good at everything, right? And you need to like prove your worth every single day, every single minute in front of everybody. And I think what I learned in the last few years is that actually the beauty of working in a company, truly, like this might sound like bullshit, but it's true, is you can actually hire people that are really good at the stuff you're really bad at. And that first requires some self-reflection, right? And some thoughtfulness about what you're really bad at, which I think is difficult for most people to maybe even have that conversation with themselves. But what I tell founders and early entrepreneurs today is think critically about what you love doing, what you are the best at. Like truly, what are you the best at as a founder or as a part of this team? And then go figure out how to spend all your time doing that. And there's no shame in that. And it doesn't mean you're not a good CEO. It doesn't mean you're not a good founder. It actually means you're doing...
How did the whole going public come about?
We'd actually been preparing to take the company public for the last 18 months. So we were expecting a traditional IPO, traditional roadshow. We had been getting financials in place, the auditing in place, kind of the basics in place, just because the business was at the scale that we felt was a really fun story for the public markets. You know, you're talking about a future of healthcare vision, which is a multi-generation vision. And then when you're looking at the economics, it's a company growing, you know, 50 to 100% year over year with 90% recurring margins and 70 to 80% gross margins. And it's like pretty simple story, right? It's a pretty exciting one. And so we were excited to get it out. And I think what we eventually decided to do was just learn about all of the different ways to go public because they've all been changing. Direct listings, traditional IPOs, the SPACs. And ultimately, we decided on the SPAC is the route because we felt like the time from a demand standpoint for the management team was just really a big advantage. Traditional IPOs take about a year or so of true management distraction. And having raised a lot of capital, I know the real cost associated with that distraction. So we decided to go on the SPAC route for a number of other reasons included, where it could be a really streamlined process. It could be 3 to 6 months and we'd be able to go tell the story to the public markets. And so from my standpoint, I think I'm a little unique versus a lot of people in the Valley who in the last decade have felt like you should stay private for as long as possible. I kind of think the opposite personally. I think the best companies build into their culture, into their DNA, the ability to tell a big vision and a big story and get investors excited and get new employees excited and really shoot for the stars while also simultaneously and in parallel building a really good and improving efficient business and doing both of those together. And I think staying private in a lot of ways encourages one versus the other. And I think some of the best companies are the ones that get good at doing both. And if you think in the past, some of the biggest companies in the world, Amazon, Google, Apple, these companies went public just a few years after they were launched, yeah. Right? They didn't stay private for a decade or two decades. They really were trained in the public markets how to balance long-term growth and long-term innovation with big vision and improving efficiency. And I think that's something I see as an advantage and I really wanted my team to benefit from it.
How'd you find your partner in terms of the SPAC?
You know, we actually met Oaktree through a board member. And we had a pretty small list of SPACs out there that we felt had teams that really could bring some unique kind of perspective to the table. And Howard Marks and the Oaktree team are just, you know, they're one of the best investors in the world. So we really loved that organization, loved those people. And we actually just decided to go with them based on our relationships and getting to know that team. It wasn't much of a process. You hear these stories of companies meeting 100 SPAC teams and negotiating and debating for the best price. You know, for me, it kind of always comes back to get the smartest, best people around the table and good things usually happen. And for me, they were the highest quality team out in the market.
No, that's such good advice in terms of finding the right people instead of negotiating and nickel and diming.
Yep.
You know, I know it's a lot more than nickels and dimes in this case, but still the same kind of concept to find the right people and the best things will happen. You had mentioned earlier just about the healthcare industry and how much it's going to change. How do you set up your company for that change? How do you know what's coming?
You keep the company as small as possible, I think, and you keep teams as focused as possible on really understanding the customer, I think is the short answer to that. We are a public company doing, you know, I think we put out projections around $200 million in revenue this year. It's about 200 employees, the whole company. And you won't see that double and triple and quadruple. It's exceptionally high functioning, high quality, veteran expert talent and with great autonomy, with the directive to understand the customer better than anybody else. And I think that's how you do it. You're constantly testing. You're constantly doing research. You're getting bureaucracy out of the way. You're allowing the people in your organization to fail and learn instead of be rigid and conservative. And I think that's how we've gotten here, right? So we've got the pattern recognition of what's worked. And I think we are doing our best to institutionalize that those things so that they don't change now that we're a public company.
Yeah. What's your ultimate goal for the business in terms of where do you want to see yourself a few years? I mean, you guys have done so much in a few years. I don't want to say like 10 years down the road, but like, where do you ultimately see yourself sitting within healthcare, or even is it a larger view?
Yeah, I think it's larger than the definition of healthcare today. It's a business whose vision is to empower people to live their healthiest lives, right? And that could be through pharmaceutical products. It could be through expert advice. It could be through simple primary care services, right? It could be through a sleep meditation that helps you sleep at night. I think it's really a true umbrella around health and wellness. And I think that's why you see us launching everything from primary care services to psychiatric mental health services to things like vibrators, which we sold out. Literally, we sold out of last week, right? It's like sexual health. When you actually get to know your customer, you get to know an individual and them and their spouse and their partner and the things they're worried about, you learn that things like sexual health toys are really important to the sustainability of a relationship, right? So I think we just know our customer really well, and you'll see us do a wide range of things because of that, but all with the intention of supporting them and providing more value to them when it comes to them kind of living their healthiest, happiest life. So from an opportunity standpoint, you know, I think when you look at the healthcare industry, it's a $4 trillion industry. It's one of the largest multi-trillion dollar industries in the country. And like I said, almost none of it has been digitized. Almost none of it. So, you know, I think there's a $30, $40 billion public company in the not too distant future if we continue to build and execute across all of these conditions. It wouldn't surprise me if in 10 years from now, there were 10 companies that were the size of Teladoc, doing exactly what we do with different specialties and different focuses on different customers. It's just that big of an industry. And it's so behind with regard to consumer orientation and digital orientation. So, you know, big economic opportunity in front of us, but I think you're probably more interesting than anything is just big opportunity to build a brand, I think, for people in this country to be well. And that gives them the tools and the ability to put their health and wellness in their own hands.
That's got to feel great. Do you ever get emails from people who are just a little, they felt the stigma, but because of your business, they were able to get the help they needed? Or have you received emails like that from customers?
I get a lot of those emails. Yeah. I get a lot of DMs on Instagram with stories like that. You know, it's in our team, hears it all day long. Like that's one of the most fun parts about building a company like this. You know, you walk down the street, you meet someone at the ice cream store, and people are talking about these issues, right? Like we used to live in an apartment building in San Francisco, my wife and I, and every month we'd see probably 20 or 30 Hims and Hers packages in the mailboxes, right? It's like a third of the building, right? And so the company is solving problems for people that are mass market problems, in ways that are super destigmatizing and normalizing, in ways that people talk about, which is really exciting. And I think that's really self-fulfilling and from a success standpoint, because the more people talk about something that was once stigmatized, you know, the more people get comfortable with the idea of taking care of it. And then it then encourages them to go seek treatment. So I think it's a fun business to build and to run for a lot of those reasons.
You still get really excited when you see those bags or outside.
I still get excited when I see TV commercials or if I hear a Spotify ad, or I love it. I totally love it. That never gets old to me.
Yeah. I don't think it ever will, but Andrew, I wanted to thank you. That's an incredible story. Congrats on all your success. And it's been a quick few years, but it sounds like you really have put in the work in the past, and especially with this business itself. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.